Hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit of Truth Church for this talk on critical theory and introduction. So here it is. We finally got down to it. By the way, I'm happy to be back. I know it's been a few weeks since I've come on the YouTube portion of this for a live stream. I need a little bit of time off, I think, also to think about what I wanted to do next. And I think it's finally time to tackle this issue of critical theory, critical race theory, wokeness, all of this kind of stuff. And we've hit on it a little bit in various times throughout the lectures, but I really wanted to actually deal with it more in full. And so in that vein, I've actually been asked by a couple people that I've shared about this with so far, why now? And the issue is, back when I had initially been thinking about doing a longer series on this, I realized it just felt like I was kind of adding to what a ton of people are already doing. There's a lot of people talking about it at that point. But it really does seem like critical theory, it's not that it's fallen off, but there's definitely less conversations about it than there were maybe 2 years ago or even a year ago. And so I thought this was a great time to get into the conversation, provide some of my thoughts on it, have some conversations with people on chat, potentially, and essentially dig into it now that, there's not as much conversation. I thought, let's generate some more conversation about it because it's still a very, very big issue. Critical theory and critical race theory and all these things, wokeness, is still very much embedded in certain sectors of society. It's not gone. And if we aren't diligent, it will come roaring back. And so I think it's worth having this conversation now. So with that, let's go ahead and get into start. I want to talk about some of the books I'll be using throughout this talk. The main book I'm going to be following is going to be Neil Shenvey and Pat Sawyer's book, Critical Dilemma. So very good book. I'll also be pulling things from Vadi Balcom's book, Fault Lines, and from Owen Strand's book, Wokeness and Christianity, and then a couple other sources as well. So I'm going to kind of be pulling from a number of different things, but we're going to be following the general structure of Critical Dilemma. I like how it's organized, and so that's one of the reasons why I chose it. And I like the depth that it does go into on certain areas. So we're going to be hitting that. Points where I may agree, I may disagree, we're going to kind of hit on all of it too. So it's kind of fun to do as well and kind of give my thoughts on the whole thing. So let's go ahead and kick this off with their introduction. And what's interesting is when Shenvey and Sawyer start the book off, in the very beginning, they kind of lay out the main issues here, and they basically say this. They say, quote, the ideas of critical theory are, quote, seriously detrimental to the common good and to basic Christian theology, end quote. And then a second quote, left unchecked, they will tear society apart and will decimate the visible church. And I think it's important to note, even at the beginning here, there's two parts to each of their critiques, or they're not their critiques, but their conclusions here. The first part is actually critical theory is harmful to everyone, not just Christianity. They say it's seriously detrimental to the common good. In other words, this is actually going to have a negative impact on society as a whole. And also that if you just let this spread, it's going to tear society apart. Doesn't matter whether you're Christian or not. Doesn't matter whether you're on the left or the right. And they kind of harp on this a little bit in the beginning too. Doesn't matter whether you're leftist or whether you're left or whether you're on the right side of the political spectrum. Doesn't matter. This thing, this critical theory stuff, is destructive. It ultimately does no good. Now, some people say, it provides some good here, some good here. If it's seriously detrimental to the common good, and if it will tear society apart, then I would argue the, quote, good things that it does or that may be perceived by people are really just dressings. They're things to make it look good, to buy, get more people to buy into it, even though it's actually a rotten thing at the core. But then there's also the question of, what happens if you incorporate this into Christianity? That's a separate question. And they argue that it's detrimental to basic Christian theology. I would agree. There's virtually no area of Christian theology that this doesn't touch, and we're going to see that from some of the quotes right off the bat, including things like God and salvation. Secondarily, it will decimate the visible church. In other words, you are going to have church divisions, church splits, people walking away from church. You want to talk, it's so funny. People talk about, if the church is, Islamophobic or homophobic or anti this or pro this or, Funny enough, if the church embraces critical race theory, that's going to do more damage to it than all the other things, which is kind of wild. But it's true, and you'll see why as we talk about what this actually entails. So they make some pretty strong comments right at the beginning. And then they go into, and I'm going to talk about each of these in turn, they go into some examples, and they spend a decent amount of time in this first introduction going through examples of critical theory in America specifically, and what are some realities now that we have to deal with in America as a result. And so we're going to go ahead and talk about some of these. Here's the first one. The first one that they mentioned is they said that there was an Islamic terrorist who committed a shooting in a gay nightclub in Orlando. Okay, this is an event you may remember from a couple years back. And the interesting thing about this is that Black Lives Matter came out with a statement on this. And here is their statement. Quote, "The enemy is now and has always been the four threats of white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, and militarism. These forces, and not Islam, create terrorism. These forces, and not queerness, create homophobia." So that should strike you as odd. Right off the bat, that should strike you as odd. The person who did it said, you know, he's doing this essentially on behalf of Islam, on behalf of Allah. Okay, now whatever one believes about that, regardless of the situation, that doesn't matter. It's just that was the declared intent. But then the Black Lives Matter movement said, and essentially, which is a critical theory movement, essentially said, no, it's not that. It's not what he said. It's we always have to blame everything on these issues of white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, and militarism. They are the sources of all evil. And that really is how it's presented. So what ends up happening is they aren't actually addressing ever the real fundamental underlying problems of society. They're actually ignoring with them and attacking things that actually keep society stable. So that's an interesting one. But notice the double think. Notice the double speak. Notice their marketing and how they're getting people used to denying reality. It's a key part of this, denying reality. Okay, a New York Times article. This one personally hurt, I think, the most for a variety of reasons, but let's talk. The article is titled, quote, "Can My Children Be Friends with White People? ? By a Black professor of law at Yeshiva University. And here's a quote from the article, again, reported in Critical Dilemma. "I will teach them to be cautious. I will teach them suspicion, and I will teach them distrust. Much sooner than I thought I would, I will have to discuss with my boys whether they can be truly be friends with white people. I will teach my boys to have profound doubts that friendship with white people is possible. I will teach them, before the world shows them, this particular brand of violent and often fatal betrayal." End quote. So that's racism. That's actually teaching children racism. That's literally teaching your children to be racists. The movement is so screwy that in, quote, wanting to fight racism, and by the way, their view of racism is very much, and we'll learn this as we go on, their view of racism is very much like systemic racism, not like true overt racism, that they've become the overt racists. I mean, that's wild to me. And this is New York Times. So this is not some backwater journalist, not some backwater newspaper or whatever. No, this is New York Times publishes this. It's like, wow. This is the power of critical race theory and critical theory. It is the power to destroy your mind. It is the power to restructure your reality. You see, what this professor doesn't realize is that this professor is not actually free in his mind. That's the interesting thing. Because if one was free in the mind, then you wouldn't have to make statements like this. But this person is now living under fear. This person is now living under a false worldview, a false reality, and is now under control of whoever promoted or set forth that false reality. That's the wild thing. Critical race theory actually takes control and takes freedom from you. Washington Post article, quote, "Why can't we hate men?" End quote. Professor of sociology at Northeastern University, quote, "Reeling off a litany of examples of abuse and misogyny, she says, quote, in this indisputably true context, it seems logical to hate men, end quote, quote, don't run for office, don't be in charge of anything, step away from power, we got this, and please know that your crocodile tears won't be wiped away by us anymore, we have every right to hate you, end quote. This is something that someone clearly hasn't thought through. They haven't thought this through. Why do I say that? Well, think about it from this perspective. Okay. Won't be in charge. Step away from power. Done. There's one thing that is essentially ultimately the seat of all power in any country in the world. That's the military. This is an injunction to leave the military. Remove all men from the military. Step away. That would be frightening. We'd be leaving our country open to invasion without even any real question about it. And people would not be afraid to do it either. You know, it's frightening when you read things like this. Because again, when I read this, I don't see this as freeing for women. I see this as this lady's making a power grab for herself. She wants to hold the power herself. And just this blanket hating of men is kind of frightening. And that she would encourage other women to engage in this type of behavior is also kind of frightening. Because again, when you engage in this kind of thinking, you are no longer in control of yourself. You are now an operative of someone else and their worldview. And here's the comment. What would the results of this be? They ask, is it healthy? Would it lead to love and unity? Will this lead to a better country? No. This leads to the destruction of families. This leads to the destruction of society and the fabric of society being torn apart. I mean, it's unbelievable the types of things this leads to. But not love and unity. Not a healthy state of living. Now the question is, how does these woke ideas like this, how do they infect people? And I think actually, if I'm not mistaken, these are sort of my thoughts actually as I was reading the book and I kind of had some thoughts. The first one was this. I thought to myself, I'm like, how do these ideas get seeded so much that it begins to warp your own view of the world and your own perception of your own life? And I said, a lot of it has to do with outsizing issues. This is why the media is so strong. First, it happens because of reporting. And the media reports or emphasizes issues in a disproportionate way. Yes, there are absolutely racist acts that go on in the United States, just along with any other part in the world. That's part of sin. That's part of a sinful world. Yes, some of them are really bad even. Wouldn't even deny that. But when the media reports those acts and they dominate the news, they dominate people's thinking, and that's like one interaction or just, even 100 interactions out of a billion interactions across the country every year or something like that, it's disproportionate. It's bad, yes. People should be held accountable, yes, but it's also massively disproportionate. In other words, don't start looking at everyone that way. But the problem is when you report on things and people think about it, that is psychologically what starts to happen. Second, it happens by getting people to emphasize and become dominated by specific events in their own lives in a disproportionate way. In other words, be defined by racist things that have happened to you. Be defined, like define all other people by these events that happened to you. So it gives events even in your own life that when you actually look at your whole life are small, individual, isolated events. And now it's like, well, no, I'm blanketing my entire life like this. This now defines who I am, okay? And third, it happens by getting people to empathize with these events in a disproportionate way. In other words, they really are relying on an abuse of emotions. They want you so emotionally attached to this stuff that the second anything happens, you're just motivated to go and be an activist. And that the only way to motivate people like that is through emotions. So there's a disproportionate emotional attachment to amorphous groups of people as opposed to actual individuals and communities in your own life. So again, a lot of this doesn't even exist without the internet too, which is also kind of fascinating. Then they bring up Vicky Osterweil, and she wrote a book defending looting. Okay, defending looting, theft, stealing. Quote, what is looting? Quote, the mass expropriation of property, mass shoplifting during a moment of upheaval or riot. And she argued this, quote, looting attacks some of the core beliefs and structures of cis-heteropatriarchal racial capitalist society. Looting rejects the legitimacy of ownership rights and property. the moral injunction to work for a living, and the justice of law and order. Looting reveals all these things for what they are, not natural facts, but social constructs benefiting a few at the expense of the many, upheld by ideology, economy, and state violence, end quote. Now, this might be one of the single most just immediately dangerous thoughts ever uttered. If you legalize stealing, your society will literally crumble. And it's not just because you don't own anything. That's bad enough. Like, not having private property, not actually owning things is actually quite bad. It's actually really bad for a number of reasons. But that's it. To legalize theft, looting, stealing, means not only do I not own the things, but I also can't prevent stronger people from simply walking up and taking everything I own. The question now becomes, well, why do anything at all if I can't actually protect my own property? This, by the way, is one of the most important things with the Second Amendment rights. The bottom line is, if you cannot rely on the government to protect your property, you simply can't do it. The government is not big enough, and you don't want it that big. You have to be able to protect your own property. The main way to do that is through show of force. So this would be, again, the reason for the Second Amendment right, is show of force to protect your property, your home, your family, your people, and your land. It's very simple. Otherwise, people can simply come on, take what they want, hurt who they will, and leave you dead and dying on the street. And again, legalize theft and watch that happen. Like, we haven't even legalized theft, but we sort of did, and look at what happened. And it led to massive theft and looting. You know, I just was watching something about businesses moving out of big cities, businesses moving out of New York, moving out of Chicago, moving out of LA. Why? Crime, theft, looting. It's not safe. You only have a society functioning where it feels safe and like it can prosper. Otherwise, you have either a totalitarian regime or you have anarchy. If you're not safe and you can't, and by safe, I don't mean perfectly coddled safe. I don't mean that. I just mean there's laws against theft and murder. That's what I mean by safe. Like, there's general laws against those types of things, okay? Again, think biblical things you would have laws about. There you go, okay? Theft, murder, that kind of stuff. So, again, when you're talking about legalizing theft, it's, like, scary. But that's one of these central premises, that you own nothing, and that these people groups that have been, quote, oppressed now have the right to go and just trash your stuff. That's scary. Then you get the Smithsonian. I remember when this actually came out and I saw a photo of this. The Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture said that whiteness is emphasis on the scientific method. Whiteness is being objective and rational linear thinking. Whiteness is cause and effect relationships. Whiteness is being future oriented. Whiteness is being doing delayed gratification. Whiteness is being polite. And whiteness is heart. It says that the hard work is the key to success. You know, if I was a conspiracy theorist, or if I didn't, you know, believe that these people who wrote this wanted to help people, which I don't think they did, I might even say that this, had this actually gone through and really gotten seated, this was an attempt to destroy non-white people. Destroy them. That essentially, well, because it was in the African American History Museum, I would argue this was an attempt to destroy African Americans, finally, once and for all. And so, yeah, because think about this. So say you have every single African American in the country refuses objectivity, refuses rational linear thinking, refuses cause and effect relationships, lives only for instant gratification, is never polite, does not do hard work, in fact, resists hard work. You're talking about, you would essentially make all African Americans, at that point, if you had them do all of this, I mean, that's horrific. That's sad. I don't want to say it. That's awful. That's awful. That's trying to destroy African Americans, promoted by the African American History Museum of History and Culture. And that's trying to destroy them. It's scary, but I've seen those types of things promoted all over the place. It's very, very scary. You also have CNN articles talking about how it's not possible to know a person's gender at birth. There's no consensus on assigning sex at birth. Yeah, that's getting the scientific establishment to back woke theory. You have the ACLU saying trans athletes do not have an unfair advantage in sports and trans girls are girls. In response to Roe v. Wade, they said, quote, abortion bans disproportionately harm Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, the LGBTQ community, immigrants, young people, those working to make ends meet, and people with disabilities. You know who they didn't mention? Women. Interesting. you know, teaching preschoolers about sexual things, that's just screwed up. So when you look at the world, you got a lot of problems here. And this is the kind of stuff that's been going on, and people are just accepting it. And it's quite scary. What about in the Christian world? Well, one of these I already knew about. Another one I didn't know about, so I'll share with them first. There's a book, Disunity in Christ, by Dr. Christenna Cleveland, made by University Press. And she spoke at the Urbana Missions Conference. She spoke at the CREW 2015 Staff Conference. She wrote for Christianity Today, did articles in there. Evangelicals recommended her. Okay, she's against, she's pro-woke, critical race theory. That's her book. Here's what happens. Within 4 years of this, by 2019, she publishes God is a Black Woman, denounces the, quote, white male God, and devotes herself to the sacred Black feminine. And she said, God is a Black trans woman. So is she a Christian? No. Is she saved? No. Did she have an outsized voice to an insane amount of Christians worldwide? Yes. Yep. Critical race theory at its best right here. Michelle Higgins has an MDiv for Covenant Theological Seminary. She's again spoke at Urbana, and now she's in a pro-choice LGBT affirming denomination. She views her organization, Faith for Justice, views everything through a Black queer feminist political lens. Again, very scary stuff, very dangerous. Also spoke at these things. Very outsized voice in Christianity, should have never been given anything like that. None of these people. Then you have Dante Stewart saying, quote, or such as saying things like, we need more womenist Black liberation, queer theology to show us how to be better humans and embody a more loving liberation faith. Yeah, that's not Christianity anymore. And then you have this article, Can White People Be Saved? Why not just hit it straight at salvation? Can white people even be saved? The comment there is that whiteness is best understood as a religious system of pagan idol worship. The comment would be no. If you're white, you can't be saved. If you're part of whiteness, you can't be saved. I mean, this is bad. And it's not in the corners of academia. It's not just in the little classrooms. No, this is in our main conferences, in our publishing companies, in second Christian and secular things. It's being promoted from evangelical churches. Like, it's an epidemic of this stuff. And just because we've had a conservative shift recently doesn't mean it's gone. That's why we're talking about it. Now, and I kind of like they had this in there, some mistaken responses. So, and I've heard some of these actually, which is why I thought this was actually a really good little section here. I've heard some of these responses. So, response number one, in other words, how should Christians not respond to critical theory? With the comment, this is all meaningless nonsense. I've heard people say that to me before. Well, it doesn't mean anything. It's just where, here's the problem. This is not a bizarre quote, this is not, quote, a bizarre, incoherent manifestation of political correctness run amok. It's not what it is. These things are entrenched in society. They're entrenched in our children, being taught in our schools. And here's one way to do this. Some might say, oh, well, I'm not affected. Let me ask you this. When I was 10, all of the adults in my life, didn't matter if they were Italian or Polish or Black or white or whatever, they had no problems at all making racial jokes in front of each other. No problem at all. Ask yourself this. Would you say that now? Would you make a racial joke now? If you wouldn't, then I'm not saying you're woke. I'm just saying then you're affected by the reality that wokeness has permeated all of society because it's changed behavior. Even if people who disagree with it, it's changed their behavior. Now, where did this critical theory come from? We're going to do more of this in a different talk, but it came from the Frankfurt School in the 1920s. It was a school of social theory and critical philosophy that was affiliated with the Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. But again, critical theory encompasses feminist theory, post-colonialism, queer theory, critical race theory. It's the whole group of it. How about this response? This is just liberal conservative political sparring, is their quote. Here's the problem with that. It's not liberal conservative. There are conservatives who are woke. There are liberals, well, there's less conservatives who are woke, but they are out there bending the knee to wokeism, if you will. And there are liberals who are like, this stuff's awful. This is not a conservative liberal thing. Okay? This hits every area of society. And the bottom line is they're pushing for a win over the whole thing, and they've made insane ground through the school systems. So that's not a good way to do it. Another quote, this is why Christians should just ignore so-called social justice issues. So here's the problem with that. Biblical justice is the real thing, and Christianity's always been concerned with it. Christians have been involved in the end of slavery. Christians have been involved in injustices around, like involved in helping overcome injustice around the world in various different categories. You know, the Salvation Army, things like Red Cross, different types of things. Having Christian, I'm pretty sure across the Christian background, I'm pretty sure, now I'm just questioning myself, but I'm pretty sure it did. But the point is that Christianity has always had a hand in this stuff, in making the world a better place. That's not what Christianity is about, though. No justice movement, quote, can ever overshadow the preaching of the gospel. That's the flaw in a lot of those things. What happened when they became liberals, because they help overshadow the preaching of the gospel. You can't do that. Additionally, anytime you try to root out all injustice, is always going to result in absolute, at best, totalitarian regime. In other words, oh, well, you know, you've got to protect everybody from COVID, so everyone stays in their home. That's totalitarian. Oh, well, you know, because this person gets offended by your speech, you can't say those things anymore. No one can. Totalitarian regimes. So that's the bottom line, is you, if you try to root out all evil, you get to a totalitarian regime. So what do? We say, well, we root out the worst of evil. Murder, theft, things that if those are allowed to continue, our society fundamentally breaks down. The other types of evil, we try to curb it through other means. If someone's going to be a racist, it's real simple. Don't give them airtime. Don't put them on the media channel. Don't give them a, you know, just if they're going to be a, you know, something, they're going to be a horrible human being. Not breaking the law, but they're going to be a horrible human being, then just don't interact with them. That's what we were always told to do, and that's worked for a long time. But that's not it anymore. Now people have to go after you. Cancel culture, all that junk. It's ridiculous. I'll share a couple of verses here. We'll first start with Micah 6:8. These are just some verses on biblical justice that I think are worth looking at. Mankind, he has told you what is good and what the Lord requires of you, to act justly, to love faithfulness, and to walk humbly with your God. Psalm 82, 2 through 3. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Provide justice for the needy and the fatherless. Uphold the rights of the oppressed and the destitute. We're called to defend people who are oppressed. There's no doubt about it. Isaiah 1:17. Learn to do what is good. Seek justice. Correct the oppressor. Defend the rights of the fatherless. Plead the widow's cause. Again, people can't defend themselves. Isaiah 58:6-7. Isn't the fast I chose to break the chains of wickedness, to untie the ropes of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and to tear off every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, to bring the poor and homeless into your house, to clothe the naked when you see him, and not to ignore your own flesh and blood? Again, there's a lot of different verses about this kind of stuff, but we are called to biblical justice, just not their form of social justice and wokeness. Now, the other big problem I want to talk about before we close tonight is this. If anybody has any questions or comments, feel free and hop in on the chat, because I see there's some people watching, so feel free and throw a comment. If you're enjoying it, let me know. And this is, we have an issue with terminology. And anybody who's been in academia knows that this can be a problem, especially in some of the softer fields. The problem is that critical theory and wokeness, all that stuff, is filled with jargon, and you're essentially made to look unintelligent or non-intellectual if you don't know the jargon. In other words, you don't even have a right to speak if you don't know the jargon. That's just silliness. That's just academic snobbery promoted at lay level, which is just ridiculous. But again, they also have this issue of, quote, the floating signifier. In other words, words constantly shift meaning, and people are going to ridicule you for even using them. So it's weird. It's like people first wanted to be called woke, now they hate it. And essentially, quote, there's no right term for some people. Quote, every term has been culturally appropriated. Every term's a right-wing dog whistle. Every term has been co-opted by grifters. So their argument is focus on ideas, not labels. Actually, this is kind of a wise idea. I mean, the problem is we have to have a way of talking about, yeah, I want to have a talk on wokeness, or I want to have a talk on critical race theory or critical theory or whatever. And I think they even call it contemporary critical theory. Yeah, that's how they say it. Contemporary critical theory. It's fine. The point is that critical theory is not monolithic. So don't go after, oh, critical theory is wrong. Go after like this. One, this core idea promoted by critical theorists, some critical theorists, whatever. The point is, go after the ideas. That's fine. I think that there's nothing wrong with that. You know, people are like, oh, that's not how I understand Marxism. It's like, okay, I don't really care if that's not how you understand Marxism. But here's what Karl Marx said, and I'm going to go after this idea. And so if you're going to talk about being a Marxist, you know, I'm going to continue to address a Karl Marx and not what you think it means, because if you keep arguing, oh, be a Marxist, other people don't even understand what you're saying. So there's that. They argue to use labels. If you use them, be as precise as possible. And they actually argue that all of critical theory can be wrapped under four things. The social binary, essentially these ideas of haves and have-nots, of oppressors and oppressed. Hegemonic power, the idea that there's this ruling class. Lived experience, which is this idea that your experience trumps all other forms of knowledge. And finally, social justice, which is the idea that you can reform and reshape society as you see fit. So that's kind of the summary of the first chapter. That's kind of what they talked about. Those are some of my thoughts on it. I'm looking forward to this, the rest of this. The next one is the understanding, how do we get there? So we're going to talk about how we got here and origins and things like that of critical theory. So it's going to be a lot of fun. But I hope you guys have enjoyed. I hope you've enjoyed this here. I'm going to go ahead and open up a Zoom call. So we will do a Zoom call. I'm feeling a little bit worn out. It's been kind of still kind of a lot recently, so I don't know how long I'm going to be on, but I'd like to be on for a little bit here. So let me go ahead and just open this up here real quick. Give me one second. Actually, give me one second. I'm going to do this. Copy invitation. All right. And remember, as always with... Oh, shoot. Hold on one second. Let me do it like this. Link. Can I just do that? Will that work? Yeah, there we go. Okay. Remember, when I post the link, it's going to be... there'll be a waiting room until I sign, because I have to shut all my stuff down, then I can open it up. So, all right. There's the link. Go ahead and get logged in if you want to come in and chat more. Otherwise, I'll go ahead and do my sign-off. Thank you guys so much for joining us here at Spirit of Truth Church for this talk on critical theory and introduction. Again, we're going to be continuing this series for a good long while, probably a solid like 2 or 3 months. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I hope to see you here again, and I hope to see some of you in the Zoom call afterwards. So with that, thank you so much for joining us, and have a great rest of your night.